Welcome to Mind Love, episode 254. Today's episode is all about how to help a loved one through addiction and recovery.
For most families, what is really important is to maintain a connection and to maintain the communication to the person who is causing you so much pain, all that drug use, and why are you doing that? To communicate to that person that you love them and that you're there for them. And then to create a boundary. So that's the other piece. So it's like connection, and maintaining boundaries. So there's a couple reasons for the boundaries. So one is to maintain a boundary so that, you know, when one of the things that happens in addiction is people will do anything to get their drugs. They'll steal from their parents. They'll lie. Okay. So there's some accountability. But the second reason to do that is because families can get all wrapped up in the use of the person who's using to their own detriment.
Turn up your frequency with Mind Love. Bite-sized brain hacks for seekers, dreamers, and doers. It's time to give your mind a little love with your host, Melissa Monti.
If this is your first time giving your mind a little love, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. Mind love is a habit, and the more you give your mind that love and intention, the better you'll feel about yourself and your life. Plus, it's really a win-win because more subscribers means Mind Love attracts even more amazing guests to bring you their wisdom. So don't forget to subscribe. Today, I'd like to share a review from Sarah Sophia, who says, "I stumbled across this podcast months ago, and I love the insight and inspiration. I'm also a huge fan of the Morning Mind Love, and I highly recommend signing up for it." Short and sweet, but I absolutely love it. Thank you so much for taking the time to write this review. Like I said before, it means so much to me. Sometimes I wonder what's harder, struggling with addiction or watching someone you love struggle and feeling totally helpless. Having gone through multiple forms of addiction myself, saying that the personal struggle is worse seems obvious. But now that I have a son, I cannot imagine watching him go through what I did. I would much rather it be me than him. What's also difficult, even though I went through the depths of it, is figuring out what even worked for me. I know which practices helped. I know what I had to do to create a supportive environment. I know what I still have to do to maintain my sanity. I know what circumstances led to me finally making a change. But what I'm not sure of is what anyone could have done to get me there faster. I've had a lot of people reach out asking for advice for their struggling son or daughter or husband. So I know that a lot of people are affected by addiction, whether or not they're going through it themselves. Sometimes I really feel for my mother. At the time, she was just this nagging voice who didn't understand anything I was going through. I remember rolling my eyes at her concern, avoiding her calls, tuning her out whenever I heard her voice. I just wasn't in a place to connect or hear her at all. And maybe we can't speed up someone else's lessons. Maybe that's not how it works. But what's trickier is that often the things that we do to try to help actually make the problem worse. So even in our best intentions, instead of speeding up recovery like we hope to, we could even be slowing it down. So what do we do? How can we help a loved one both before they're ready to help themselves and then when they're starting to see that there could be a better way? Well, that's what we're talking about today. Our guest is Allison Webb. She's a recovery ally, advocate, author, and seasoned public health specialist. She's also the author of Recovery Allies, How to Support Addiction Recovery and Build Recovery-Friendly Communities. So three key things we will learn are how a history of trauma affects recovery, how allies can reduce the shame and stigma that can prevent people with substance use disorder from asking for help, and how to support your loved ones with the four pillars of recovery. We're all here just trying to live our best lives, right? And while you're here listening to a podcast, you might feel like you're on the right track, but then you visit family, or you have a work deadline, or something unexpected comes up and you're all stressed out and it feels like all the work is out the window. That's why it's so important to consciously curate what you can control, like who you surround yourself with, what you watch, what you listen to. So I'm going to add another podcast to your toolbox, The Dr. John Deloney Show. He has a PhD in counseling and has been sitting with hurting people for 20 years. He shares practical advice for everything from how to connect with people, how to face depression, overcome anxiety, and learn just what it means to be well. But what's really cool about his show is you can even leave a voicemail or send an email, and he'll address your topic or question about mental or emotional help on the show. So no matter what you're going through, the Dr. John Deloney Show is here for you. Listen to the Dr. John Deloney Show wherever you get your podcasts, or follow the link on the website. And now let's welcome Allison Jones Webb to the show.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here.
So what sparked your passion for helping support people through recovery and addiction?
I, like so many Americans, come from a family where there's a lot of substance use. Grandparents, my parents' generation, aunts, uncles, cousins, and then nieces and nephews. And so it's a topic that I know about just from living it a little bit. But then, you know, when the overdose crisis hit maybe 12 or 15 years ago in my work, I was assigned to sort of understand overdose prevention. And I just got really impassioned about hope, right? So yeah, overdose is awful. Addiction is awful. And we have so much hope in the world. And so that is what I try and focus on when we talk about addiction. I try and focus on the hope of recovery.
One of my passions as well, I've been through so many addictions. There's a lot of people in my family that have dealt with addictions. And I think my first intro to it was my own father. Thankfully, I didn't witness his addiction much. I guess my mom did those first few years until they got divorced. But thankfully, he really switched his lifestyle around, mostly motivated by me. And so I saw him in recovery. I only knew the sober version of him. And I was the kid playing with blocks in the corner of the NA meetings and the AA meetings, hearing testimonies I probably shouldn't be hearing when I was way too young. But it really did leave an impact on me. And part of it in the way of, I mean, it's kind of interesting how I fell down my own rabbit hole of addiction after my dad died. But I think one of the reasons I was able to get out of it is knowing what was possible through him and being exposed to so many people at such a young age. So it wasn't just this new thing that I had no idea how to get out of. Maybe there was a part of me that let myself fall because I'm like, you know, when I'm ready, I know that there's steps, there's people that'll catch me, there's communities. And so I've thought about it a lot though, because I've had people reach out and they're like, well, what helped? My daughter's struggling with bulimia, or my son's struggling with opioids, or whatever it is. How do I help? And it's such a difficult question. And it's not helpful to a lot of people when they learn that recovery outcomes are so poor. Why do you think that the statistics for that are lower than we would hope that they would be?
So I'll say a couple things first. So, you know, I've talked to so many people who understood that if they were going to have a relationship with their children, they would have to change their lifestyle. And so I understand exactly where you're coming from as that child in the NA and AA rooms, is that it's a huge motivator. And it's a way that people sort of find their way to changing their lives and learning how to care for themselves, as well as caring for that little kid that's playing with blocks in the corner. And so it's a familiar story. And I wanted to say a couple words also about family. So, you know, in my family, we never talked about anything, including substance use. And so what I have noticed with people in recovery is that often, not always, but often in their families, they learn how to talk about what's going on and not just about the substance use, but about some of the reasons people are using, emotions people have that often we just don't bother talking about. Things get bottled up, things get misunderstood, and so forth. And so I do want to just talk a little bit about our record keeping and statistics on substance use disorder as a condition and recovery. So our statistics and record keeping are very poor. And so we actually don't know from a hard and fast statistical analysis what the outcomes are. But generally, the data do show us that most people who have a substance use disorder, mild, moderate, or severe, will recover, most people. And that for people who have a more severe addiction, it's about 50%. So I think what happens when we are discouraged about the outcomes is that we see the poor outcomes and not the positive outcome. So that's one thing that I'll say. I think also oftentimes when people get on the other side of their addiction, they're not particularly interested in talking about it. They want to move on. And so the recovery side of things is much less visible than people who are living with addiction and the consequences of their addiction. And also because we have had this tradition of anonymity with AA and NA and other 12-step programs, again, people in recovery are far less visible than people who have active addictions. So I'm not sure I would agree with your characterization that our outcomes are poor. It sort of depends on which group of people you're talking about. If people have a problem, but they aren't, you know, living in full-blown addiction, their outcomes are probably going to be pretty good. If we're talking about a person who has a serious opioid use disorder, then that's going to be a much different picture for recovery.
That's really good to know, because I know a lot of people, sadly, who struggle with their own things. It might not be as severe where it's so life-threatening. On one hand, it might be like my relationship with alcohol that I gave up a year ago. I had really moved to a place where I was moderating in comparison to before, but it just took up so much thought and it still wasn't serving me and blah, blah, blah. And I know a lot of people like that, because when I gave it up, the amount of people that I know that just drink socially that are like, you know, I'm questioning my relationship with alcohol, blah, 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 blah. And I've had probably 5 conversations in the last few months. And it's just like, well, I mean, even the people that try to quit, most of them can't. And I'm like, well, that is a belief out there. And if that's your belief, that's really going to affect what you're willing to do, because it's hard to go into something that you think is impossible or really, really difficult.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, was to really get out there to the general public that recovery is not just possible, it's probable, and that there are things that we can do in the community to support that transition into recovery and then support people who are in recovery for a year, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. The support system, you know, needs to be there. You know, I think the more we talk about addiction and recovery, the more we will find experiences like yours that, yeah, I had this problem. It wasn't huge, but I didn't like what was happening. And so that's a mild substance use disorder, and I really knew I needed some help. What's really important then is to know how to ask for help and where to go for help, and to be able to talk about it, as you said, with your peers, because then you find out, oh, I'm not alone here. It turns out that there are a lot of people in the same boat.
So when you talk about recovery allies, what is the role of an ally? This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I really need to get something off my chest. Being a mom of a 3-year-old boy is really freaking hard, and sometimes it has me questioning my sanity. But then he'll grab my face and call me his sweet little mama. Yes, that's a real thing he says. And it will all melt away until I break his banana. I thought I was done with emotionally abusive relationships, but nope. We all carry around stressors, big and small, and when we keep them all bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. For me, just talking things through is hugely helpful, but it's so hard finding friends and family that are unbiased or non-judgmental. And therapy isn't just about dealing with major trauma, you know? It's about learning healthy coping mechanisms, setting boundaries, becoming the best version of yourself. And BetterHelp makes it super convenient too. Everything's done online so you can fit therapy sessions around your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindlove today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindlove. I'm constantly sharing with my clients to stop searching in life and instead start aligning. It's true with purpose, with relationships, with higher versions of yourself, and it's also true for hiring. The best way to search is actually just to match with Indeed. Indeed is your one-stop hiring platform with millions of job seekers visiting every month, and their powerful matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. Plus, Indeed lets you schedule interviews, screen applicants, and message candidates all in one place. But Indeed isn't just about speed. They also deliver quality. According to a recent Indeed survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. I love Indeed because it makes hiring so much easier. I'm all about alignment in all areas of my life, and that includes people I hire to work in my business. So I need a hiring partner that makes it simple to find candidates with the right skills. And that's Indeed. And what's really cool is Indeed's matching engine gets smarter the more you use it, learning from your preferences and over 140 million qualifications. Plus, I love that I can do all my hiring in one place. It's just one less thing to keep track of between all of the other things. So join over 3.5 million businesses worldwide who rely on Indeed to find great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/mindlove. Just go to Indeed.com/mindlove right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/mindlove. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. So when you talk about recovery allies, what is the role of an ally?
Oh, I love that question. Thank you. You know, an ally generally is a person who probably is not in recovery herself, but wants to find a way to support either another individual in recovery or to support generally the recovery community. So the recovery community is huge. And as we were just talking about, people who have a severe problem or a mild problem, people who identify in recovery sort of span that whole continuum of substance use disorder. And so there are a lot of things that allies can do to support that entire community, as well as to support an individual. And so an ally is going to be somebody who cares about the issue. I heard a woman a couple of days ago introduce herself as, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an ally because I just care about recovery. Other people find a passion in the issue because there are so many sort of human rights and social justice issues that happen to particularly people who are currently using drugs, who are using illegal drugs, and they get pretty passionate about human rights for those folks and social justice because we know that addiction hits different communities at different rates. It's not the same. And so there's some injustice there involved of why does it hit brown and black communities harder than other communities? People get involved for that reason. But in my experience, for the most part, allies have been touched by addiction. And it's very often in their immediate family. It's very often children. And very sadly, it's often children who have passed because of an overdose. And that creates anger. It awakens the heart. It creates a desire to do something. And so all of those folks kind of fit into the category of allies.
Yeah, I know so many people that have been addicted, let alone, you know, touched by addiction. So it's really difficult this day and age to not be touched by addiction. And I find that people handle it a couple of different ways. They either become hardened to it, like they have, I'm thinking of a couple people in particular where they just have no patience for it. They do not understand it. And those people tend to have not dealt with their own addiction, or they are currently dealing with their own addiction that they're making excuses for. Mm-hmm. and then there's the people that are trying. They're trying to learn about it. And then there's the people who ignore it completely. And so it's difficult to really know what to do, because if you see someone struggling, even I go back and forth with, sometimes I do feel like the best thing is to allow people to hit their own rock bottom. Because I found that when people were cushioning that for me, I tended to pull them down with me, or it would make my rock bottom even lower because it wasn't that uncomfortable down there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then, but then at the other hand, I'm thinking of a family member whose mother just kept taking him in. And there's the balance of trying to figure out, well, yes, of course you want your child to be able to come home. And are you making this easier for that person? Like, where do you even start around that? And then also, when you're looking from the outside in, it's so easy to kind of judge other people's issues. And so I even know people who are like, yeah, but that person's addicted. Clearly they need to give this up. And it's like, look at your own life. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So I guess to start, define addiction, because I know that you say that it's not as straightforward as it might seem.
So, you know, if you ask a healthcare provider, they will give you the brain disease model that your brain becomes used to using a substance, needs it in a way that creates a compulsion, and then you can't control your use. If you speak with people who are more interested in our social lives and the sociology of addiction, they will talk about the alienation that we often feel, either from ourselves or from others around us, that cause us to turn to something to give us a connection. And people get pretty connected to the drug that they're using. You can talk with psychiatrists who in particular focus on adverse childhood experiences, people who have just had tremendous pain in their childhood and or later on in life, but pain that often leads them to use a substance that kills the pain. And so those are sort of the roots of addiction. The sort of the symptoms of addiction are things like, well, a compulsion to use regardless of what the consequences are. And so even when you know that you're supposed to be, you know, watching your child, you decide to pick up a drink and then another one and then another one, even when you know that you're not at your best while you're watching your child. And it can spiral pretty quickly just because of the way substances work in our brain. So I guess the answer is that, you know, there is this brain aspect, and you could call it a disease if you want to call it a disease. That's helpful for some people, that makes it really difficult to stop. It sort of takes your choice away somehow or other. But there's also this other aspect of, like, it's just a really human thing to do to want your pain to go away, whatever that pain might be. And that's, you know, one of the things that we did see was people who became addicted to opioids as a result of surgery, for example, because they were prescribed painkillers. And they found that the painkillers actually worked really well on their physical pain and also their emotional pain. So there are all these different aspects of addiction that make it really hard to say very simply what it is or what the roots of it are.
Yeah, I read a book all about how addiction is not a disease, and that was helpful for me. But what I also recognize is that I look at things different ways depending on which part of my own process I'm in. Sometimes labels really, really help me. And then when I get to a certain point, that label doesn't help me anymore because I feel like I'm stuck there. Sometimes it's helpful to think my brain is just different. And in a way, that's true, because there are changes that are made to the brain when you're dealing with addiction. Whether you not look at that as a disease or not, for me, it was helpful at first. And then it became something where it felt like it tied me to it when I felt like I wanted to move on. Mm-hmm. And so now that I feel like I've rewired my brain, I no longer feel like I have this disease that's inevitable that'll be with me forever. And I also know, though, that because I've struggled with it, because I've created those neural pathways, I have to be a little bit more careful with certain things than other people do. So there are lasting brain changes, but there's also a lot that you can do to kind of rewire that. And that's just what's landing with me right now. And I also recognize that the disease model was really helpful for getting healthcare coverages and getting employers to understand that it's not just, oh, I just keep making the same choice and I'm ruining my life on purpose. So I think the way you look at it really depends on what do you feel is serving you in this moment, and reflecting back on that, because what serves you in one moment might not serve you in the next.
So I think that that's a very useful point to make for people who are listening and also for family members who are listening. So for some people, the disease model of addiction is tremendously helpful in allowing them to understand, like, why did I do what I did? Like, why? It's very helpful. And, you know, there is this phrase in the 12-step programs, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, or once an addict, always an addict. And for some people, that is very helpful because it reminds them every morning when they get up that they, if they start using again, life is going to go haywire. And that is their condition. For other people, it's really more like a life sentence, like, oh my gosh, this is forever. And so, you know, I think you're right. It depends on where you are, depends on who you are. For family members who watch someone that they love do these things that are just incomprehensible, going out at night, being in unsafe places, using substances when they don't know what they are, just doing really unsafe things, it's very often helpful to understand that, look, that they're not trying to do this to make you mad or scare you or what have you. It's not personal, that there is this disease aspect of it. You know, there are other people who think about the disease aspect as a spiritual malady. And again, that could also depend on where you are in your own recovery. For some people in the religious or, you know, in the faith community, understanding that addiction is a disconnection that a person may have with their creator or with their soul is also often helpful, that this is just a, again, this isn't willful act. This is like a broken soul or a soul that's in pain.
Looking at it in all of those different ways at different parts of my journey has also been helpful for self-forgiveness. Because now that I've moved on, now that my brain is acting differently, now that I understand where I am and I can make conscious choices, it's easy to look back on that former self and just think, like, how stupid, how much of your life did you waste, you know? But I also recognize that it was that girl that got me here. With all that she was struggling with her brain not functioning the way my brain does, with this pull towards these substances that she couldn't get rid of, she still made decisions to begin to step out of that. And so she laid the building blocks for where I am now. So, and I think that's important because I do think that for a lot of people, they move on in one aspect, but they kind of get stuck in that self-forgiveness. It's hard to forgive yourself after you make what you think of as mistakes. And it's easy to take who you are now and judge who you are then. And so, you see it from the outside. It's just like, you know, the mother with a perfectly working brain, like you said, saying like, why are you doing this? Like, it's so dumb. Like, stop it. Can't you see what everyone around you can see? And I touched on earlier how people react differently to that. Like, do you keep allowing them to come back? Do you cut them off? Do you let them just really feel the weight of their own downfall? With all of your research and the people that you've worked with, how do you advise people that are just beginning to confront someone that they love with this?
So I think that the research is very clear. And what people in recovery told me is also pretty clear, is that it is important to maintain a connection with the person that you love. Now, you know, there are situations where it's not healthy for a parent, let's say, to stay in touch with the child. Like, that's just not a healthy relationship. But for the most part, for most families, what is really important is to maintain a connection and to maintain the communication to the person who is causing you so much pain, all that drug use, and why are you doing that, to communicate to that person that you love them and that you're there for them, and then to create a boundary. So that's the other piece. So it's like connection, maintaining connection, and maintaining boundaries. So there's a couple reasons for the boundaries. So one is to maintain a boundary so that, you know, when one of the things that happens in addiction is people will do anything to get their drugs. They'll steal from their parents. They'll lie. You know, they'll do these things that in the future they may, you know, they may regret and they, you know, may need to make amends about, but they'll do that. And so as a parent, the boundary is really important to say, no, that's not okay in this house. That's not what we do. You know, it may send the person to somebody else's pocketbook to steal from or what have you, but drawing that boundary in a very loving way it's important for the person in who's using to understand, like, oh, I guess I can't do that here. Okay, so there's some accountability, right? But the second reason to do that is because as a family member, you know, families can get all wrapped up in the use of the person who's using to their own detriment. And so they don't take care of themselves. They don't take care of their own relationships with each other. And, you know, I've talked to siblings of teenagers who had addiction problems, and the siblings feel completely ignored. And so that's not a healthy family environment either. And so those boundaries around what you can and can't do in our house and what we are going to do, the rest of us, we are going to do to take care of ourselves are really important. Doesn't mean there's going to be a happy outcome anytime soon. And I think that's a really important message, which is there's no silver bullet. It's not magic. It's a lot of hard work on everybody's part. And that's why maintaining that loving communication is so important, because when the person's ready, you want to be ready also to say, yes, I want you to come now and we'll go together to, you know, to the doctor's office or whatever it is, wherever it is you think that treatment is available. And the other thing that family members can do, which turns out to be more challenging than you might think, is to do some of their own research on just what is available for the particular condition that their loved one is in. If it's alcohol, it's different than if it's opioids, it's different than if it's methamphetamine, it's different than if it's cannabis. And so doing some research, figuring that out, learn what's available locally so that if there is a moment of readiness, which sometimes is really just a moment, you're ready to act. And then the last thing I'll say is that sometimes, it's not always, but in some communities, there are support groups for family members who are living with a person who's in active addiction. And the people that I've talked to that I know just find that tremendously helpful. But not all communities have those.
Yeah, I was in a relationship with somebody with addiction, and it was easier to focus on his than my own. So when his was worse, I'm doing air quotes right now, than mine was at the time, mine was kind of developing. However, I did join Al-Anon, and it was really helpful. It helped give me some tools, ways to think about things, kind of seeing other people go through it. It actually also helped me to see my situation with this person in a new light, because it's so easy to make excuses for someone that you see all the time. And it was also helpful when I was going through my own addiction and what I expected from myself and from other people. It almost like it was a blueprint for me, like, where it's like, yeah, no, I'm not even going to go try this, because that's only going to like make things worse for me and that person, whatever it was. But most people do know about 12-step. And I know you say that there's different pathways for recovery for all of these different issues that people deal with. What are some examples of some that aren't just AA or NA? Most people do know about 12-step, and I know you say that there's different pathways for recovery. What are some examples of some that aren't just AA or NA?
So I appreciate that question, because I think, you know, in this country for so long, the only available help was AA or NA or Cocaine Anonymous, you know, the other A's, the other anonymous programs. It's probably surprising to you that more than half of people who are in recovery don't receive any assistance at all. They're called self-healers. It's about, I don't know, let's say 50 or 60%. And so they figure out on their own what it is that they need for help. And so sometimes people read books. People may get counseling for some of their internal conflict that doesn't have to do with alcohol, but has to do with like why, you know, they're deciding to drink. And some people find their faith community very important, even if the addiction itself is never discussed. But that connection with other people and with their creator is really important. But in terms of other specific pathways, so medication is a very important pathway, somewhat for people with alcohol use disorder, although it's not very often prescribed. Very much so for people with opioid use disorder. You've probably heard about methadone and Suboxone, very much an important part of a pathway. It's not the answer, but it's part of the pathway. And then there are programs. I'll give a big shout out to SMART, recovery. And now I can't remember what SMART stands for, but it is a recovery path that's based on the tools of cognitive behavioral therapy. So learning what your actions are, why you're taking actions, how you might like to change those actions, exploring your own behaviors, exploring the cost benefits of like, well, what do I get out of drinking every night? And what are the costs to me? And do I actually want to change that or not? So SMART recovery is a pathway that people are choosing. There are a couple of faith-based recovery programs. There's one for women called She Recovers. These are all online also. So a lot of this stuff has moved online. It's been online and then it's expanded online because of the COVID pandemic. And then for people who either are Native Americans or are moved by that tradition, there's a program called White Bison and others, but those are the biggest ones.
Technically, I was a self-healer, but I did find a lot of support in books. Like for me, when I'm trying to move past something, I need to really surround myself with new information, new ways of thinking, other people's stories, people who don't drink or do Adderall or throw up their food or whatever the things that are that I have moved beyond. And when I was first starting, I guess the first thing I really worked to heal from was bulimia. And for some reason in that state of mind, I just felt like I knew more than the people that were trying to help me. So even therapy wasn't really working for me because I'm like, I know what you're going to say. I've already read stuff on this. It's just if I'm choosing to take the steps. But one community or two communities on Facebook that I found were super helpful is the Sober Curious Facebook group and this Naked Mind Facebook group, which accompany two different books. But just people's vulnerability and sharing things, or when you ask a question or even just vent that, you know, I slipped again. There are hundreds of people who will comment and give you words of support and different ways of thinking that are kind of outside of the neural pathways that you've created. So I found those really, really helpful. But another thing I'm wondering is, for the families, when they're like, okay, you need to change, and you said that waiting for that person to be ready, that's kind of outside of the idea of intervention. It's rarely that the person is ready when you have this intervention. Are interventions helpful, worth it? Should people even try it? Or is it just a way to kind of set off all the resistance of the person who is clearly not yet ready for help because you've just bombarded them in a living room with all these people?
So that's a really good question. And I think the answer is not all interventions are the same. And so if we think about intervention, like the television show where there is bombardment in the living room, there are professionals who conduct interventions in a very loving way. And the idea really is to, again, maintain that loving communication with the person who's using to create a moment of readiness in the living room. Let's say it's in the living room. And so I know that there are successful interventions. There are successful ways to do interventions. I would caution families about looking in the, you don't look in the phone book anymore, looking on, you know, Googling interventions near me and just picking up the phone. That it really does require a lot more thought and sort of professional level knowledge and experience to effectively communicate to someone, here's what needs to happen. We care about you. And so it's really not, you're not forcing a person, you're sort of moving them towards that point where they're ready themselves.
So don't Google how to easy intervention on the fly.
You might be successful, but probably not.
Well, one of the things about talking to people with a substance use disorder, it's really hard if you look down on it or if you don't understand it to have those loving conversations, but you bring up the point that the loving conversations are such a key part of it. But there's stigma on both sides. One person's dealing with a lot of shame. The other one might be actually ashamed also of their own child or whoever it is. The other person might have resentment and judgment and all of these human emotions, which I also think is important to bring up because we're humans. We judge. We have preconceived notions. If that person has hurt us, of course, we're going to have some resentment there. How do you work beyond those emotions to do what's necessary, which is really reducing that shame and that stigma that's coming at that person from all angles. What are your tips for that?
Well, so we do know that shame and stigma are the main reason that people don't seek help. And so if we are contributing to that shame, either in our household or in our neighborhood or in the community, we're really making things worse for the people who are trying to seek help. And that's documented. We know that. And so if you're a person that wants to be convinced by factual information, if you are shaming someone who has a substance use disorder, you're part of the problem. I think that in terms of actually addressing our own stigma, this was a challenge that I had myself, because I think I mentioned, you know, in our family, we didn't talk about it. But the reason we didn't talk about it was because there was so much shame. And so, you know, just opening up a conversation and saying, hey, let's talk about Uncle So-and-so was definitely not the way to do it, because that's embarrassing everyone and shuts people down even more. So what some of the literature shows us and what people in recovery also said was really start with your own attitudes, like look inside and really question yourself. So if you have a child who's using and you are mortified, of course it's embarrassing. You know that the community is looking at you and saying, what did you do wrong? You're a bad parent. We actually know that parenting is not the reason that people use substances, but sort of examine your own attitudes. And so for me, you know, I did look at why people didn't talk in my family. Who was it that they weren't talking about? What I actually thought about when I read in the newspaper, oh, there's somebody else who got a, you know, DUI again. Oh, it's listed as the third time. They've really got a problem. And having my own attitude of judgment about that. So it can take some time. It can take some work to understand, now, wait a minute, how would I, if I understand that that person who got the third DUI clearly has an alcohol problem, and I'm actually not making this up because there was a person that I knew who showed up in the newspaper three times and I had that knee-jerk reaction. And then I thought, now, wait a minute, I know that she wouldn't willingly have done that. And I know that she must be totally ashamed of herself. And here she is in the newspaper about it. How would I feel if that was me? And what would be a better way of understanding her situation? So I really encourage people to just kind of think about their own situation. And I honestly think that it's pretty hard to say, oh, we're just going to get rid of shame and stigma. I'm not really sure that's possible, but working on it in our own selves and in our own homes is like the first place to start. And the other thing that I think helps people sometimes, I have noticed this with parents, is that if they just say, you know, the heck with it, I'm just going to talk about it. You know, I have a son, he has a problem, and I'm not embarrassed to talk about it. I love him. I want help for him. And I want other people to understand that, you know, he's a good kid or whatever your approach is. And so those are the things that come to mind, you know, when it comes to shame. But, you know, families are shamed. Families are absolutely shamed. And so we bear the shame, but we also bear the responsibility of speaking out.
Yeah, I feel like my big takeaway from that is if you're approaching someone or hoping that someone's going to do the work to get out of something and you want to be a support system, you're going to have to do the work too. And they always say addiction's a family disease, and it really is, because it affects everyone around them. And the more that you want to help, the more it likely will affect you because you're choosing to insert yourself into that. And there are ways that you insert yourself that only do more damage versus ways that can help. So if you really do want to help, then showing up for that. And I will say the work I've done on both sides, first trying to help somebody else, then trying to help myself, and now trying to help other people again, it's rewarding in all of the ways. You grow. Like, it's not just about having your vision tunnel visioned on somebody else and getting frustrated when they don't do all the things that you hope they do. You work on your own, you know, triggers, your judgments, and you, I feel like I've really become a better person through that process. So when you look at it that way, then it's not just this waste of time and this person's taking all of your time. It's really kind of a dance together in your kind of combined evolution in a way. But I'm wondering, for a lot of people that struggle with these things, they come from a history of trauma. And So they might be working on the addiction, but there's all of these underlying things. I've had so many conversations with people too, where it's kind of that judgmental, like, I don't understand this person. They keep going back to this, and I'm all I can see because I do this for a living. I have these conversations is, look where they came from. Like, do you really expect that they would have known a different way out? And so what do we have to know about how someone's history of trauma affects their recovery? And so what do we have to know about how someone's history of trauma affects their recovery?
So there's no question at all that early trauma, any type of trauma, is an enormous risk factor for using substances. And that sort of circles back to the pain that I was talking about. When you have emotional pain or psychological pain or physical pain, you know, and you want it to go away, substances can do that for you. And so we need to have an understanding that while everyone is responsible for their actions, there are things that happen in a person's life that create this pain that sometimes is really difficult to bear. And I think the two things that would be most important to understand about a person in recovery from substance use disorder is, number one, if there is that type of trauma in their past, they're probably in recovery or working on mental health conditions as well. And so it's not like, well, just take away the methamphetamine and everything will be okay. It doesn't really work that way. And so addressing both that addiction and then the mental health issues, could be depression, it could be schizophrenia, it could be bipolar, it could be a lot of things. Addressing those at the same time is really important. So our thinking used to be, look, first thing you got to do is just get rid of the substances before you can even think about the mental health situation. And I think we're sort of evolving in our thinking that, in fact, you got to do both. Like, you can't just take away the drug and then kind of see, oh, let's see what percolates up, and then we'll address that. You need to do both at the same time. And the second thing is that just because a person stops using substances and is working on their mental health doesn't mean the pain goes away. And so, you know, I interviewed some people who, you know, their recovery just didn't look like they wanted it to. It just didn't. It was an enormous effort for them to accept that they weren't going to get the life that they saw on TV or on social media. They were going to get the life they had as a consequence of the things that happened to them. And so for us, you know, supporting people in recovery who have had past trauma, you know, our expectations should be to understand what it is that they want, to understand their path, and then support that path. Because we might think that, well, they should, you know, go to college and get a PhD and do this and do this and do this. And like, that's just not, it's not what is possible for them. And so, you know, I think it's really hard to say that sometimes a person's recovery doesn't look like what they want it to look like, but they have it, they own it, and they find a way to love it.
Yeah, for some reason, the visual that came to mind, it's like, you know, when you tie your conscience into a knot versus it's been tying into knots for years and years and years. So you've got this big bundle of like, where do you even start? And that's really how I view trauma, because it's hard to pinpoint one thing. It's hard to know what's still affecting you. It's hard to really spot those deeply ingrained reactions. Our amygdalas are still responding to something that happened when we were two that we might not even have a conscious memory of. So patience with that, because, you know, it takes a lot less time to untangle one knot than it does a whole lifetime of knots. But one thing that you really support people with is you talk about four pillars of recovery: health, home, purpose, and community. Where do you start there? Is it kind of coming at all of these angles at one time, just kind of padding support around somebody? Do you start at one and move on to the next? How do we navigate these pillars?
So those pillars are based on research, things that we know that people in recovery need. And it's people in recovery, usually from a pretty severe addiction. But we all need those. We all need a home. We all need, you know, we need our health. We need a purpose in our lives, and we need community. And so it's important to understand where a person is in her recovery. So if it's early recovery from a severe addiction, this person may be homeless or may be coming out of incarceration or maybe in unsafe housing. And so if that's the situation, housing is pretty much the first thing that needs to be straightened out, because if you don't have safe housing, it's really pretty hard to maintain any kind of a healthy lifestyle. But if you're a person who you're 50 and you've just been drinking way too much and you still got your job, but things aren't going terribly well, you know, you've got your house, right? So you're already there with that one. And so you may need to be looking at your health, right? So it's sort of looking at where the person is and what they need most immediately. Very often it's housing and safe housing. And so what does safe housing mean? So safe housing means an environment where you get the support and connection that you need to feel like you're a part of something bigger than yourself. It also means a place where you're held accountable for what you do. These are all like steps towards having a healthy lifestyle. And then it means a place where you have an opportunity to do something meaningful. So often for people in early recovery, doing something meaningful is volunteering because they don't have the bandwidth for a job at that moment. Or so doing some volunteering or work, starting to go back to school, working to get your kids back. That is an enormous motivator for people who, you know, have just had pretty lousy things happen to them, including having their kids taken away. And so oftentimes, okay, well, that's a priority, getting my kids back. And so what is it that I need to do if I am working with the state, which now has responsibility for my kids? What are they telling me I have to do? That's my priority list, right? But further along, you know, in the recovery journey, as people become more stable in their physical life, so they've got their housing straightened out, they've got a safe place to live, and they've dealt with health issues. So there are very often health issues that come along with being in early recovery that need to be managed. Getting a good doctor is really important. And dealing with your spiritual life, so your spiritual health as well. These things all kind of come along. And then you reach a point where you're really ready to have a community around you, in addition to maybe those people that you're living with. And so reaching out to other people in the recovery community seems to be so critical. And, you know, you were talking about the online forums with, you know, where you could, where people would give you advice, or Facebook, you know, groups. Peers are just so incredibly important at every stage of recovery, but all along. And so reaching out and finding people that can support you. So that's sort of the community aspect. So I think that the overall answer to the question is, well, it sort of depends on where you are in your recovery and how severe your substance use disorder was, as to where, like, kind of what you look at first. And the other thing is, you know, if you're a family member and you really want to offer support, here's the first thing you do. You ask the person who's in recovery, what's most important to you right now? It might not be the answer that you want to hear. You might want to hear, as I said, oh, you want to go back to school. Oh, I'm going to go fix that for you. The person actually may just want to have a pet. I need a dog, whatever, right? Whatever the answer is, that's where you start. As long as you have some of that, the physical safety aspects in place.
I also want to ask about relapses. I know for a lot of people, especially when they're watching somebody else, or even if they're going through their own relapse, it can be really easy to be like, oh, now I'm starting from scratch, or I just wasted all of my work. What do you know about relapses? Are people more likely to recover if they've recovered in some way or to some degree before? How do you coach people through that so they don't just lose all their hope when they either witness it or they experience it themselves?
So that's a really important question, because relapse is sort of part of the disease of addiction. If you think about it as a disease, it's certainly a part of using drugs. One of the ways that we are thinking about return to use, as opposed to calling it a relapse, but a return to use, is, okay, that's happening. What do you want to do now? Still want to use? Want to try something different? But also, how could we use this as a learning experience? And so often in a person's career as an alcohol or drug user, they may have had a day, they may have had a week, They may have had 2 weeks where they just said, okay, I'm done now. And it only lasted a day, or it only lasted 2 weeks, or it only lasted a month. But those are all experiences of what it's like what was it like to not use? What was it like to pick up again? That inform where you're heading if you think your direction is to like just not use at all. And so both those periods of not using can be considered part of recovery, right? A change in trying to make your life healthy. And then when you return to use, also an opportunity to learn. So one of the problems with this approach, however, is that for people who use opioids, a return to use can be deadly. And so with the drug supply the way it is now, and just because of the nature of the way opioids work in our brains, returning to use after not using for a period of time can precipitate an overdose. And so from that point of view, a return to use, calling it a learning experience, is kind of hollow because it can be very dangerous.
For me, and I recognize that my experience with giving up alcohol was very mild in comparison, because I got to this point of moderating. It wasn't really negatively affecting a ton of people around me anymore. It was my own personal thing. But I gave up drinking for a while. Then I got pregnant, so I wasn't drinking. And then I was kind of glorifying it in a way. You know, I was just like watching the other people on the patios and whatever. And, you know, I could do that. And I wasn't craving it quite as much. And so I did return to use. And that was really important for me because I was able to experience what it was like without it. And then all of a sudden be really honest with myself of what it was like with it. And it made it so much easier for me to stop the next time. And so on some level, even if somebody's experience is so much deeper than mine, where they go back to destroying parts of their lives and those around them, at least they had a taste of what it may have been like. And I know you can watch shows like Euphoria, where the main character is sitting there in her recovery just wishing she was still doing it. But I can clearly see after this conversation, she didn't have any of those pillars of support. I know I'm talking about a show, but it's one that a lot of people watch. And so that is why it's so important, because is that recovery period something that's actually a supportive environment with loving people around, where they're making something of their lives, finding purpose, or are they just stewing in their old life without any of the things that numb the pain? And so that's so important. But the last thing I want to touch on, because I think it's really hard for people, allies, to understand, is the methods of harm reduction. We have a few of those, and it can be anything from providing clean needles or safe injection sites, decriminalizing drugs, and it can be looked at as two ways. You know, they're going to do this anyways, so might as well make sure they're not getting all these other diseases with it. Might as well. It's like, I'm the cool mom. You can drink as long as it's here, and I'm here. You know, it's like that. But on the other hand, people can look at it as a way to enable these really dangerous habits. What should people know about harm reduction?
Well, I will sort of say out of the box that I am a huge proponent of harm reduction. It is so clear, both from sort of medical evidence, but also from the experience of drug users, that it plays a tremendous role in keeping people safe, or safer than they might be without it, sometimes for very long periods of time. And sometimes, you know, we have this idea that everybody should be striving towards recovery, and recovery means abstinence. And somehow that also means, you know, some very traditional lifestyle, when in fact, you know, that is not the goal that a lot of people have in their lives. And so for people who either want to use drugs or are not at a point where they want to stop using drugs, harm reduction services are super important. So, you know, the traditional harm reduction services are clean needles, clean supplies, other types of supplies, and then often like a referral to treatment or a referral to a healthcare provider. So a place where people go to get their supplies, make a connection, maybe get some healthcare, maybe get some counseling, and then maybe a referral to treatment if that's what they want. And so that's the traditional view, and sort of expanding that now, as you mentioned. So legalization of drugs, or at least decriminalization, is part of an approach to harm reduction. And there's this notion, which it took me a really long time to understand, that harm reduction is love. So what does that mean? Like, how could that possibly be? But in fact, you know, supporting people where they are in their lives, whether they're using drugs or not, is a really important way that we support each other. And so supporting someone who's using drugs with love and also with services is a way of accepting, okay, this is where they are. Again, might not be where I want them to be, but it's where they find themselves because of their life circumstances, because of the world around them. And what we want to do then while they're in that spot is to keep them safe. It's a tough concept. It's a very tough concept. And I think one thing that I have noticed is that mothers in particular, but fathers also, of young people who have died from opioid overdoses, is they, after they go through this wrenching grief, which probably never ends, they come out to the other side on harm reduction and say, well, of course we should support harm reduction. It's what keeps our young people, or keeps them, in that case, you know, our child safe. So I think that our old ideas about harm reduction from a medical point of view, and also sort of, well, it's chronic drug users, we're just trying to keep them from spreading HIV into the general population. You know, those are not our attitudes any longer, that they're broader than that.
Well, thank you so much. What I've learned throughout my lifetime is that so often what we think about as a common sense approach is really the opposite of what we should be doing. Even when I was a crisis counselor, I remember going through training and thinking, this is how we do it? Like, all of the things I wanted to do that I thought were just, of course I'm going to do this, are actually recommended against. And so it's so important to educate ourselves if we're really trying to be an ally and trying to support somebody through something, especially if we haven't had that personal experience mm-hmm. ourselves. So I know that I get this question all the time, how do I support my loved one? And now I have the episode to point them to. So for listeners that are interested in learning more about you, the services that you can help guide people towards, and your book, Recovery Allies, where's the best place for them to connect with you?
They can go to my website, which is pretty easy, AllisonJonesWeb.com. And they can, there's more information there. They can email me from the site. That's probably the best way to do it.
All the links for this episode will be at mindlove.com/254. Your challenge for this week is something that we didn't necessarily cover in the episode. But if this is an episode where you're like, yes, I need a challenge, this episode was for me, this is what I'm struggling with, what I'm going to ask you to do is your own self-care routine. A huge part of this process is learning to let go. And as difficult as it is, trusting that this person is on their own journey, knowing that whatever happens is and was always outside of your control. And if you're spiritual, the way I like to look at things is that this is the path that that soul chooses to learn through. And I know when you're going through it, it's so much more difficult to accept something like that. And if you're like me, you find yourself arguing back, like, what kind of woo-woo bullshit is this? This is not what was meant to happen. This is not the path that my son or daughter was supposed to take. But the thing is, what else can you do? Often, whenever we try to tighten the reins around somebody, their goal is to loosen them as much as possible, to show that you don't have control over them. And one of the things that was really helpful for me, even in the depths of my despair, was watching other people have happy, healthy lives. Yeah, sometimes it was triggering, and it would cause me to go deeper down my path. But I think seeing that it was possible was this glimmer of hope that I always held on to. And so the only way to show up the best you can for the people around you is by first taking care of yourself. For me, that looks like meditation, movement, good food, sleep, all of the ways that you take care of the vehicle that is your body, and then your mindset and your spirituality. So if there's any way that I can assist, please reach out to me at MindLoveMelissa on Instagram. If you know someone that needs this episode, I know plenty of us know people that are affected by addiction, whether or not they're going through it themselves. Please tap the share button and send this to them, or take a screenshot, tag me, send it to them on Instagram privately, or share it publicly on your story. If you feel compelled to write a 5-star review, I will always take it. I love them. I actually get an email digest of new reviews, so I see them first thing in the morning, and it's my favorite way to start the day. You can also join MindLove Premium at mindlove.com/premium, where you get a whole lot of exclusive content that will only be available to you, including meditations, exclusive episodes, ad-free listening experience, and early release episodes. And you can find any of my sponsors at mindlove.com/sponsors. And that's all for today. So thanks for giving your mind a little love today, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning into Your Higher Frequency with MindLove. Head to mindlove.com for a free gift to keep your vibes up until next week.